listening to Wellness Wednesday, a show about health and wellness in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. This week,
Peace Talk with the Tundra Women's Coalition.
Good morning and welcome to Peace Talk with the Tundra Women's Coalition. My name is Gabby Salgado. I'm here sitting across from Taylor Finley.
Morning, Gabby. How are you today?
Doing good this morning. Today we are talking about protecting and empowering men and boys. And you are the expert on this subject, so I'll let you lead the conversation.
Sure. So I was sort of looking back over topics we've talked about on Peace Talks since I've been doing it. And it tends to be a little bit gender specific. A lot of our statistics about violence focus on female identifying or women. And I took a step back and was like, okay, let's look at this a little more broadly. Who are we not talking about? What issues have we not mentioned? You know, even TWC is called Tundra Women's Coalition, right? And one of the distinctions I like to make with people is that Tundra Women's Coalition doesn't mean that it's an agency for women. It means it's an agency that was created by women, but it's for everyone. Around town, people may have noticed that we have like an ad campaign up for TWC where it says Tundra Everyone's Coalition. TWC provides services for all people of all genders, all identities, and we have advocates that are specifically trained to work with queer folks, women, men, sort of whatever your gender identity is, there are safe and acceptable services for you. So with that, I thought we'd sort of take a little bit closer of a look at what interpersonal violence and violence prevention looks like for men and male-identified people. I was reading a study in the Journal of Men's Health yesterday, which is, again, sort of looking at our unconscious biases. Journal of Men's Health is not something I open up very much. It doesn't often directly correlate to the work that we're doing in domestic violence and violence prevention services, which I'm learning through this episode to sort of check myself and make sure my understanding is fully formed as well. But according to this study that I read, it was talking about the experience of male victims of interpersonal violence in the United States. That research said that up to about a third of cases and experiences of domestic violence include a male victim. That's a whole bunch. And I'll tell you right now that that does not at all match this number of people seeking help. The number of men experiencing domestic violence or interpersonal violence or stalking or sexual assault, the sort of interpersonal violence that we're talking about here includes all of those. A third of people experiencing violence are men, but of those third of the men, only about 15 to 20% ever even call a hotline for support or services. And that's a really low number. A high number of people being impacted with a low number of people who are reaching out and getting help. Some of the statistics also said that looking at child abuse and child sexual abuse, as many as 1 in 6 boys will experience sexual abuse before turning 18. And I think culturally and even in the victim services sort of arena, we sort of have this idea in our head that those numbers maybe aren't true or that's not our experience because we don't see it in victim services. But it's really important to remember, and what I'll talk about a lot today, is just because we don't see it doesn't mean it's not happening. If enough people are speaking up and sharing their stories to generate statistics like 1 in 6 boys or 1/3 of domestic violence involves men, we know that there's a huge portion of people experiencing violence that aren't getting the support and the assistance they need. So yeah, we'll sort of look at today some of the reasons that men or boys either don't seek services or are receive lesser quality services. I was, again, doing some research on this, and in the United States, there's only 2 domestic violence shelters that are male-specific. I mean, I can think of 10 off the top of my head that I've done direct work with that serve women exclusively, or places like TWC where we do serve everyone and we have services available for everyone. But sort of the general consensus and the understanding of it is that it is a women's shelter. So that really took me back. Of all of the thousands of victim services programs, domestic violence shelters across the whole United States, only two of them have, you know, advocates and facilities that are directly created to help men experiencing domestic violence or interpersonal violence. I think looking at sort of zooming back and, okay, why do we only have two of those shelters? Why don't men report at comparable numbers to women? How is this problem so rampant and no one really talks about it? I think there are a lot of things that go into that, you know. So if we sort of zoom back from the service provision level, we do look at what we talk about all the time on Peace Talks, our social and cultural norms of what, as a collective society, do we understand men's roles to be? Why would it be a problem for men to ask help within those strict cultural and societal roles that we have? Why would it be a problem to engage? You know what I mean? We also do, in the violence prevention world, we do have to sort of work with two truths at once. That's so often the case in social services. We're living in a situation where it is true that a very large percentage, somewhere I believe in the like 80% of perpetrators of violence that are reported are men, while at the same time, there are still large numbers of men experiencing violence, whether that's in a situation that involves another man, a woman, or someone else. We get into the sort of nitty-gritty of the service provision of, at TWC, you know, we're a facility that has shared bathroom spaces and shared shower spaces. And when people who identify as female have gone through something like domestic violence or sexual assault, sometimes it's really difficult to be around other men who are strangers. It can be very triggering. While the converse is also true, that of course that could be the case for men as well, given the numbers that we see in the YK Delta, it's really difficult to have a male-identified person who is over the age of 18 in shelter. We were just talking last week about, you know, in a theoretical future where TWC expands, where we have more resources, more space, what do we need? And one of the first things our shelter manager said was, we have to have a separate safe space for men, both because we have people who need those services. We get those calls and we're able to help, but it's, and we're able to give people shelter, but it's in a very like non-traditional, every time we have to be creative in having a designated space where even one person or two, a few people could say, stay safely with their children, if that's relevant, and keep them safe and keep all the other people in shelter safe. But those kinds of, you know, funding to support interventions that would help both men needing help and keep the environment safe and comfortable for everyone receiving services, those are things that are like sometimes difficult to fund, just again because of the statistics that women experience more violence by at the hands of men. Again, that is true, but then we do also have to take into account who isn't reporting, what aren't we hearing, and just because most people identify as one way, that doesn't mean we don't provide equitable, same support services for men. So looking at, in practice, how those sort of cultural norms, how these big societal things that keep men from reporting, that keep advocates from understanding how and why male victims present differently than female victims, all of these things are really like wrapped and tied up together into a problem that is difficult to solve because we're I mean, I'm going to keep saying it. It's like so many things are true at once here. And it's our responsibility as service providers to make sure that everyone has access to safety, has access to support, and has an opportunity for a violence-free life. Since we're on Wellness Wednesday, we'll kind of look at that from the violence prevention angle. So I actually was going over a document from STAR, which is another domestic violence provider in Alaska, and they put together a document that gives a lot of information about how to empower boys, young men. So that is focusing on early education, as we've talked about a whole bunch, is the best way to move the needle on problems or issues moving forward, is to empower our next generation, empower our future leaders to understand the problem or to have a reality where these social norms that are causing this problem perhaps aren't so stringent, or perhaps that's not how they understand themselves or the world. So we'll look at, first of all, our early education. So while, you know, when we're going and we're giving violence prevention presentations in schools, they are non-gendered. You know, we're already talking to children as young as preschool up to senior year of high school. Those curriculums look different by age. So for young children, we're talking about child sexual abuse prevention. We're talking about what's called the no-go tell rule. The no-go tell rule in child violence prevention is if someone touches you inappropriately in a way that is not to keep you safe or healthy, you say no, you go, you leave the space that you are in, and you tell someone. So we teach every kid from preschool to, usually we do that until about fourth grade, and they hear that message every year in school. They learn what a safe touch is. They learn what consent is, and they learn, we teach names for body parts. We're trying to instill in children of all genders what safety feels like for them, what consent means like for them. And that helps empower men or boys in two ways. It helps them to understand their own bodies. It helps them to have tools and resources if something is making them uncomfortable. It teaches them who their safe adults are and where they can go if they do need help. It makes it normal to ask for help and to talk about those things that are hard and uncomfortable. And then on the other hand, in that style of violence prevention education, learning about consent, learning about boundaries, it sets up boys to understand the experiences of others too. It instills them with that messaging at a very young age so that they understand that asking for consent is important, whether that's for a hug in first grade, or if that's, you know, to have sex when they're older. Like, that instilling that core belief of consent and body autonomy that applies both to them and to those around them is one of the best violence prevention tools we have. So in the information from STAR about sort of gearing and specifying these styles of teachings to boys, it's really talking about that knowledge is power, and that staying informed will help ensure your child's safety and other safety around them. Some of the phrases, some of the tools that parents can use or other community members who work with children can use regularly around young people, especially around young boys, empowering them to enjoy themselves, the way that they look, the way that their body feels, helping them feel comfortable in their skin. Like, it's my body and I like it. I like the way that I look. Talking with kids, like we mentioned, we have safe touches, touches that hurt, like tripping and falling, like an injury, ouch touches, as we call them. Or secret touches. And secret touches, we talk a lot with young people about how adults shouldn't ask you to keep anything secret. There shouldn't be anything that you can't talk about. And that really helps to combat the don't speak out myth with boys. So many times as boys get older, they understand themselves to be future men, to be the leaders of a family, to be the stronger of the sexes. These are all in quotes as just like beliefs that are commonly held. And as those sink in with children, it makes it easier for a perpetrator to get them to keep a secret. If boys already understand that they should be strong and that they shouldn't cry, it makes it easier for a perpetrator to make them keep those feelings in, to not tell someone that they're safe and that they trust. pardon me. Another thing that we talk with kiddos about, sort of along that line, is the difference between like tattling and telling. A lot of the times young people sort of get like hung up on, well, the person who is doing this thing that makes me uncomfortable is someone that I love or someone that I know or someone that I don't want to get in trouble, and helping sort of break down the difference between tattling and being mean and talking behind someone's back and telling someone who is safe because you feel unsafe. Starting to build those ideas of healthy relationships, of personal boundary setting, like laying the foundation so solidly that as a child continues to grow, as a young boy ages into a young man, that they have the tools and the skills to speak openly, to know which relationships are safe, to know who they can talk to, and know that the most important thing is safety and being able to have those safe relationships. And then encouraging open communication. A lot of times, some problems in reporting are that topics like this are difficult to talk about. That's especially true with men and boys because of all of the social stigma around receiving assistance as a male person. Asking for help, appearing weak, taking emotional damage. Like, there's all of these negative and incorrect social stigmas that say this isn't something that you do if you're a quote-unquote real man. Getting that out of there, never beginning that sort of internal dialogue for a young person, and talking about issues like this really normally, really regularly, making sure, like, we try in shelter to, like, do a library, what do you call it? A story hour, sorry. Like, we read a book about a topic like this once a week is what we try to do, so that this kind of language, words like consent, anatomical name for body parts, talking about how you feel if you're upset or angry, like, really normalizing emotions talk, normalizing talking about what makes you feel safe, what makes you feel scared, normalizing speaking up when something is uncomfortable. Like, you'll notice in violence prevention land, it is all educate, create opportunity for dialogue. Our best thing, the best thing that we can do is give people the words to tell us what is happening. Because when someone is comfortable to talk about it, that's when we can help. If people don't come to us, we get these huge statistics of men not receiving assistance.
Yeah, I feel like not having the words to talk about it is really a big thing. I know we've talked about this the last few peace talks, but just giving people the opportunity or the language that they need and the comfortability, I don't know what I'm looking for, to have those conversations is really important, because like you're saying, like, prevention is key. If get that information when the kids are younger, so that they know what is expected and what is not expected, what is right and what is wrong, and having that language to then go tell a safe adult or tell somebody to have those conversations. But and we talked about this the last few peace talks as well. It's hard to start those conversations when although you are getting this information from safe adults, from TWC, there's also this so much input from like outside society telling mm-hmm. you certain things or things should go a certain way. What are some ways that as a provider, as someone at TWC, how do you encourage young people to start those conversations, to create that space that people feel comfortable in?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it has a lot to do with like group culture. Like in our Teens Acting Against Violence after school group, we worked with the teens to sort of establish like a group consensus of what is and isn't okay while you're in TAV. Is it okay to tease people? Yes, but the boundary is XYZ. Collectively having an understanding of what is and isn't appropriate is really important. TAV is an easy example because it's a group that I work with really regularly. And, you know, most kids start when they're in young high school or middle school and will stay in TAV through high school. So you sort of see how those group dynamics evolve over time. So when young people start in TAV, you know, sometimes they don't know each other. Sorry, I'm not close enough to the microphone. There we go. Sometimes they don't know each other. And having this sort of shared understanding of what will happen in this group is where it starts. And then from there, as the safe adults in TAV specifically, or we in general as safe adults in community, the best way that we can support that respectful, safe, caring environment is to A, model appropriate behavior. Modeling kind, safe behavior is one of the most powerful tools we have. I'm really careful with myself to not self-deprecate, to not say negative things about myself, even though, like, maybe talking with my friends, I would say something different and joke around about myself. It's really important to speak of yourself highly in front of young people, modeling the behavior of self-respect as well as respect of everyone in the group. And then the other really important modeling behavior that we can support young people with is calling out when those boundaries or group agreements are violated. So many times, you know, a teasing thing hurts a little bit, or someone says a word that maybe they don't quite understand, and creating a safe environment where everyone feels included, and so that a call out isn't like a cut off. Saying something, creating an environment where it's okay to correct, it's okay to learn, it's okay to make changes moving forward and do different next time. Those are really great ways that we can pay close attention as adults who are safe people. And also, young people are able to support each other in that way. Like if you noticed a friend or a family member that's uncomfortable, being the one to practice speaking up creates like collective safety over time. So those are the really important ones that I notice. And just last week, for example, because our TAV folks have been around a long time and they like have learned our group agreements and they're comfortable with each other and we've fostered this great culture of respect, I had a situation where two young people had a disagreement. They had a hard time and were having trouble getting along. And instead of it causing this huge divide, instead of it blowing up, they both came to me and said, "We need help talking about this." And so we sat down all together and we talked through what was going on, figured out where one person's boundary was, where the other person's boundary was, and how it could go better next time. And I was just like, have we done it? Did we do the violence prevention? Because that's exactly it. Creating that space where that can happen is what, you know, the goal is on this small scale and a much larger, broader one as well.
It sounds like you've done the violence prevention.
We're working. We're doing good work.
Going back to like speaking out and finding the space to do that. And again, I feel like this comes up every show, and it's so important, so that's why we keep bringing it up. But what are some ways that, as an individual, as a community, that we can, like, help break this stigma of not speaking out?
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, we're talking about empowering men and boys who, as we know from what you said earlier, the rates are mm-hmm. much higher than what we see in the statistics due to people not talking about it. And you've given us some methods that we can take back to our classroom, back to our daily lives, to encourage young people to know the language. But how as a society, as a community, as an individual, do we help, you know, make people feel comfortable
mm-hmm.
in talking about things that are so difficult and so stigmatized?
Absolutely. I think you sort of have to look at it in almost like a three-prong way. So way number one is that the education piece of just like literally saying it all the time, of having it normal to hear about what rates of violence look like, to hear that even though it's hard to talk about, that things like child abuse, child sexual abuse, sexual assault, domestic violence, hearing those words, knowing they happen, making it feel normal for people who have had that experience to say something about it, that sort of desensitization process of, yes, it is hard to talk about, but the more we talk about it, the less hard it becomes over time. So that's kind of the obvious sounding one. But then our sort of second tool is tapping into those cultural norms and combating them. And what that looks like is, for example, you know, we just heard the U.S. men's hockey team situation. So this is a great example. So the U.S. men's hockey team won a gold medal. So did the U.S. women's hockey team. And important people called and were like, yay, men's hockey team. Haha, I guess I'll have to invite the women too. So sexist. Like this, that is a cultural norm that sports are for men and that women in sports don't work as hard and it's not as hard because this gender difference in sports is so serious. Not true. So untrue. So this cultural norm that sports is for men leaked its way into this top level conversation. And then when all of the members of the men's hockey team heard this sexist joke, they all laugh, right? They hear this from a person in power and they all laugh and they go along with the joke. Here is our opportunity to do better, to do different. So to combat a cultural norm, to move the needle, to be a supportive person of a minoritized group in a situation like that, which can feel small, like a silly little joke. Does a silly little joke hurt anyone? Yes, it does. And seeing that whole team of professional athletes say nothing reinforces the message to every single person who plays hockey, every single person who watches the Olympics, that it's okay to laugh at sexist jokes, that sports are for men. If anybody in that group would have, I mean, even just not laughing, you know what I mean? That's a start. But the remaining silence is complicity. So if we, as I often say on this show, flex our say something muscles, we practice speaking up when we hear something that is damaging, inappropriate, mean, or not funny. Like if one person would have said, I think they're just as deserving of being there, or I can't wait to celebrate with the women's team, anything. Like, there's not necessarily like a call out that has to happen. You can recognize that in situations like that, there are different dynamics of power, but in practicing saying something, if you hear a friend at school say, you know, like, men don't cry, man up, like saying, actually, like, that's even saying like that's dumb, you know, like that's silly. Everyone has emotions. Combating those in little ways, like these micro instances of the upholding of cultural social norms. It's a chip away. It's a slow, intentional chip away. Right. Unfortunately, you and I aren't the ones making the social messages. We're not the ones who are reinforcing these narratives in popular media, you know what I mean? So we don't necessarily have the power right now to make these huge shifts and make those beliefs go away. But what does happen when you, on a phone call, say, actually, I can't wait to celebrate with the women's team because they played just as hard as us? That takes one chip away, and it makes one person think, you know, it makes one person think, why did I laugh at that? It makes one person think, oh, yeah, maybe that wasn't funny. And as we, you know, continue to take those steps forward and we help people sort of look in the mirror, sort of hold up an accountability mirror towards people, sometimes that collective upholding of a norm is like so deeply buried that people kind of don't even realize that they're supporting it, you know what I mean? And help just being the person that speaks up, that chips away at that norm each and every time, whether it's online, whether that's with your family, whether that's at school, the power that that has is immeasurable. And that's where change begins to happen too, and that speaking up. And then I'd say the third way to sort of, if we're talking about mentioning, like bringing up terms, talking about hard things, having that language be normal, then recognizing when things make you uncomfortable, challenging social norms, being a person to speak up in a social situation. Sort of the third thing, I would say that, you know, education and speaking out, those are very like, I don't know, extroverted things, right? I think that a really great way to, you know, move the tide, to help support, to shine light, pardon me, and to help reduce this problem over time is to educate yourself, you know, examine your own biases, look at what your own cultural norms and understandings are. There's some really great tests. I like to share these with people all the time. Harvard made these tests called unconscious bias tests. And these tests were developed by researchers to identify which group an individual is more comfortable with. And they're really simple tests that just like flash images. And it's sort of the one that your brain gravitates towards, you click on. And all of the research that went into this test shows that whatever you're sort of most comfortable clicking on is what you naturally favor in life. There's unconscious bias tests about race, about gender, about sexuality, about country of origin, and you take these tests and you sort of see like, oh, I feel more comfortable engaging with media that reflects white people, and you're like, oh, okay, that is an uncomfortable thing. Understanding yourself and learning your own knowledge, you have a lot of power, and then what you choose to engage with, as what you choose to spend money on. If speaking up with your voice isn't something that feels comfortable, speaking up with where you invest your time and money is a really great way to help shift cultural norms, to help reduce violence and reduce these types of stigmatizing behaviors for young people, for boys, for men. One other thing I did want to talk about is that as it is more normal to talk about things like violence, to talk about things like sexual assault, that inevitably comes with higher rates of disclosure. If we make a comfortable place, people will talk about their experiences more. And many people don't know what to do when they hear a disclosure. When someone tells about something violent that happened to them, what do you do, right? Going all the way back to the beginning, when we were talking about that study in the Journal of Men's Health that said only 20-something percent of men ever even call a hotline, the number one reason why people did not call a hotline is because they felt invalidated. They felt like they weren't understood, right? And so when disclosures like that happens, whether that's with a young child, whether that's with an adult or anything in between, starting with supportive things to say. And I literally just have a list of phrases that I'm going to read because I think it sounds obvious, but it's important to have these in your memory bank, making it so easy to just respond automatically, saying, I believe you. You did the right thing by telling me. I'm so sorry this happened to you. It's not your fault. You were very brave. I'm here for you, and I'm going to help keep you safe. You can talk to me anytime. So easy, so simple, right? Those aren't difficult things to say. Having those in your back pocket so that when someone discloses something, we've created this safe environment. We're now having more people engaged. And the worst thing is to say the wrong thing in that very vulnerable moment, to make sure that you are a picture of support. Sort of in the domestic violence world, it's not our job to be investigators. It's our job to be supporters. We do not ask questions about who, what, when, are you sure, couldn't it have been this? That is not our job. Our job is to respond to those disclosures, to support people, to empower people. And as responders to those disclosures, some of the most important things we can do once we've said one of our supportive things, I trust you, I believe you, I know how hard it must have been to say this, thank you for trusting me. Once we've responded initially, making sure that we stay calm, you know, that we find our way to regulate. In taking difficult information, it's not just hard on the person telling you, it's hard on you too. Making sure you have safe like coping mechanisms or strategies in the moment to remain centered, making sure you're actively listening to people. So often in the victim services world, we will start jumping forward to, okay, I heard this disclosure, so that means we need to do this, which means we need to call and we need to get a protective, and we're already five steps ahead, right? We're already five steps ahead and trying to genuinely help and be the person that can solve all the problems, right? Well, of course, yes, that's important. Listening, being present, being calm and grounded in that moment of disclosure is the most important supportive thing that you can do. So often, especially with like the state of the criminal justice system, there's not always concrete justice. There's not always concrete reparation after all of this harm. And so the best support that we can be as a listener, as fully hearing and absorbing the experience, the truth, and letting someone get that off their chest, whether that person is male, female, a boy, a man, whatever age, that listening skill, that listening tool is the most supportive thing that we can do.
I feel like that's really important because I feel like outside of the stigma of reporting the assault or whatever has occurred, there's a bias within just society in general that when you hear a report from a boy or a man, mm-hmm. I feel like it can be played off. And because we don't see these statistics every day, mm-hmm. and you hear so much about women going through this, obviously, because the rates are higher, but there are still cases for mm-hmm. men and boys significantly, and you just don't hear about them. So when, as the receiver of that information, if you're like the person who is...
Yeah, if someone discloses that to you and they're like, what do you mean?
Yeah,
like, that doesn't happen to men.
Exactly.
Shutting that person down to never speak about it again.
There's like a fear that you just won't mm-hmm. be believed.
Absolutely. I
mean, for everybody, there's a fear that you won't be believed. And so having that language, I think, mm-hmm. is so important. And I might have you share it again as we get closer to the end of the episode.
Absolutely. I love a list of supportive things to say. And honestly, saying supportive things is another thing that we should practice. We're flexing our say something muscles and supporting people and saying supportive, kind things. Because if we say that every day, if we say kind, supportive things to our friends, our family every day, when a disclosure happens and it's a hard conversation, then suddenly it's so much easier to say the thing you always say. So yeah, we'll absolutely go over them again. I actually, you sort of got us right into it. This document from STAR has a list of why boys may delay reporting. And I thought that since this is based on research, it's based on the reasons people report. Specifically in this document, it's talking about violence against children and boys. So we'll sort of just go down that list. We've covered some of these, but I think it's important to hear again. Why aren't boys and men reporting? Fear of not being believed or being blamed for what happened. We talked about the gender bias within domestic violence services, how two things can be true, of course, that males perpetrate most violence, statistically speaking, and men experience a lot of violence, statistically speaking. So worrying that they'll be blamed because they're in a relationship with someone who is more regularly perceived to be the victim in a domestic violence situation. Shame or embarrassment, especially if the abuse involved physical arousal. That's a really huge fear that male victims have, that if their body responded by getting an erection, that means that they wanted what happened to them, and that means it's not abuse. That is not true at all, but it is such an understandable fear, right? If someone can say, well, this is what happened when I did this to you, what do you mean that's not what you wanted? Understanding that your body and your brain act and natural bodily functions happen involuntarily in all kinds of situations. And that fear and embarrassment is such a huge barrier to receiving help, support, reporting. And if you're a safe person who can talk about anything, who easily uses words that are difficult to talk about, that can help mitigate that fear a whole lot. People don't report because grooming can create emotional bonds. It can be someone that they don't want to get in trouble. We talked about that. They don't report because it's someone they know and spend a lot of time with, someone they don't want to see get in trouble, even though they're uncomfortable and want that to stop. It's testing. Young people get confused, and it feels like a test of loyalty. They don't want to betray someone that they care about. And so really talking, teaching, reinforcing that love, respect, safety does not involve these sets of behaviors. And if these sets of behaviors are happening, that person does not love, respect, or keep you safe. Sometimes people are afraid. They feel that they're being manipulated or receiving threats. Cultural expectations that discourage boys from showing vulnerability or seeking help. Lack of awareness, not knowing what to say, not knowing how to verbalize what is happening to them. Confusion about masculinity or sexual identity, particularly if the abuser was male, a male-on-male situation. With all of the stigma against queer folks, of all of the homophobia that's in society, if something dangerous happens in a male-on-male sense, there's the additional stress or fear, embarrassment that come along with that sort of intersection of male violence and sexuality. So that creates an even steeper sort of hill, proverbially, to climb for folks. Lack of understanding of what happened was abuse, especially at a young age. If people don't know what a safe touch is versus an unsafe touch is, they can know they feel uncomfortable, but a lot of things make people feel uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to talk in front of a crowd, you know what I mean? And when you're very young, when you're very small, your brain doesn't know the difference in types of discomfort, right? And so not having the tools and the language can reinforce that and keep things quiet. Fear of retaliation, fear of getting in trouble. Child abuse, you know, can involve many things. Neglect, lack of access to resources. So, like, withholding food, there can be all kinds of, like, retribution from an abusing parent. Children are afraid of getting in trouble, of being hurt. concern about being labeled or stigmatized, especially among peers. This we see a lot as kids get a little bit older, middle school, high school. People don't want to have a reputation to be bullied in school if people know what happened to them, to have jokes be made about them, things like that. Those are the biggest, according to this report, reasons why boys choose not to say anything, why this type of violence goes unreported. And I think we've talked about some things that can really help with that, which is great. And so really, the final portion that I want to really drive home is ending stigma, right? Stigma around talking about sexual abuse, around men experiencing domestic violence, around, you know, saying words like, I don't know, intimate partner violence, saying things like rape or sexual assault, like having that stigma of we don't talk about it, we don't do anything about it. Like, how do we break that down? So like we've talked about again and again, educate yourself and others. Learn about sexual abuse. Understand the facts and dispel myths. Be the one who said, actually, that's not true. Actually, women are great at sports. You know what I mean? Be that person. Share information. Educate your friends. Tell them to listen to this podcast, radio show, show. Tell them to listen to this. If you don't feel like you have the skills to educate someone, point them to a resource that can educate them, whether it's this, whether it's TWC, whether it's another national network for domestic violence. Educate yourself by reading it. Share it with someone else. Support survivors. Listen without judgment. Provide a safe space for survivors. Believe and validate. Believe survivors and validate their feelings every single time, period. That is our job, is to listen, not to investigate. There are people whose job that is, and it is not yours as a safe, supportive community member. Encourage seeking help. Support survivors in getting help and utilizing resources available to them. And of course, I clicked out of my third one that had it written what the third thing is. So I'm going to scroll back to it. And then challenging harmful attitudes. Speak out. Challenge harmful attitudes and stereotypes. It's like that speak out. I was looking at a statistic recently where I think it said it was like one in like 50 or something like that says something in an in-person bullying situation. Like if a group of people witnesses unkind behavior, the likelihood that somebody says something is just like infinitesimal. It's so little. Be the person that speaks out. I'll share on our TWC social media pages. Some teens in Valdez just did an amazing PSA on it, and I would love everyone to see it. So check out Tav's Facebook page, and you can see this really awesome PSA that shows that speak out, that challenging harmful behavior. Promote empathy. Show children what healthy relationships look like. Use that modeling tool. Be the person who is safe, comfortable in a healthy relationship, can deal with conflict healthily. Have children understand boundaries, respect boundaries, and also help them make their own boundaries and respect them as an adult. So often, children don't have a lot of autonomy, and so having adults that listen to what children want is so powerful. Not making your children hug or kiss relatives, not making your children eat or wear something that makes them uncomfortable, allowing them to set boundaries will help them develop healthy relationship skills as they age. And then finally, advocate for change and support. Looking at a broader level, you know, putting our money, putting our votes, putting our time into efforts and people and causes that uplift and support survivors, that make it easier for men, boys, and people of all genders to talk about openly what happens to them, and supporting initiatives that bring in additional funding and support to continue providing services. End that stigma.
End that stigma. Do you want to give those those phrases one more time.
Absolutely. We'll close out with some supportive things to say. This is specifically in responding to a disclosure of assault or sexual assault from a child or an adult, but also having supportive things to say, these things can apply and can be used in all kinds of situations. So let's remember how to be supportive together. Saying things like, I believe you. You did the right thing by telling me. I'm so sorry this happened to you. It's not your fault. You're very brave. I'm here for you, and I'm going to help keep you safe. You can talk to me anytime.
Thank you for sharing those. Before we sign off, I just want to have you give us the TWC phone numbers for people who are looking to seek help or just ask questions that they might have. I think it's important to get those on the airwaves.
Absolutely. So our hotline number, I'm so sorry. I always look it up just so I don't say it wrong and have it wrong on the air. So our crisis line toll free is 1-800-478-7799. And our local crisis line number is 907-543-3456. That's our crisis response line at Tundra Women's Coalition. An advocate is on the phone 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year to talk, point you to resources, answer any questions you have, and be that supportive, safe person for you.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Talk about really important topics, and I'm glad that you were able to come on Peace Talk.
Yes, thank you so much. Everyone support each other. Yay.
Thank you for listening to Wellness Wednesday, a show about health and wellness in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Listen online at kyuk.org or tune in live every Wednesday at 10 a.m. right here on KYUK.